Hello everyone to this episode of the Lang FM podcast. I'm here today with Elisabeth Tiselius, who is in town for a workshop. We'll talk about that in just a second. We're here in, not in a studio, but in a co-working space in Brussels, which is called The Mug, which is a first for me. We're recording on site and Elisabeth is sitting right in front of me. Hello, how are you?
Hi, I'm very well, thank you. And thank you for having me.
Sure, it's my pleasure. I just said you're here in town for a workshop because you're usually not based in Brussels. Can you tell us what the workshop is about?
Yes, I live in Stockholm and I'm responsible for the teacher training at Stockholm University. And the conference interpreting training, typically in Europe and also in other places, have a lot of cooperation with the SCEEC, so the interpreting unit at the European Commission. And one of the things they do, and which we're very happy about, is giving pedagogical assistance of different sorts, and this is one of them. This is a workshop for trainers, so a training for trainers course. And for a week, we dive into all the pedagogy and didactics of teaching conference interpreting, and it's very good because you get a lot of input both from very seasoned trainers at SCEEC, but also from different universities, different settings, different student groups, and yeah, so very, very interesting. And
I think we have to mention it's not entirely altruistic that SCEEC has this pedagogical assistance scheme because, of course, we want to improve interpreter training, but of course, we're also interested in having good interpreter training so that we can have good candidates that would eventually work for us.
Exactly. You want to train the trainers so that they do the right thing, right?
Exactly. Well, what we consider the right thing, which is not always the same as what is needed on the national markets, but I think that's another podcast episode right there. But it's not the only part of pedagogical assistance, actually, because there's an annual conference as well where SCEEC meets universities.
Yes, there's an annual conference called SCEEC Universities, where we are all, I usually joke about it because I say that we're all called into Brussels to know what we're going to do the next year, which is partly true, but also it's a very good networking opportunity. It's very good to, they usually invite very good presenters to present different current topics in the interpreting world, such as training or pedagogy or research. And it's also the take home message from SCEEC. What would we like you to concentrate on? And typically also an open forum where the trainers can ask questions and put forward suggestions and so on. And obviously there's a lot of people there and many interpreting programs and universities, so obviously it's difficult to make yourself heard, but I think that basically it's a good opportunity for exchange of views and network and so on.
Yeah, I was just going to say, because so many people are there, it's also a very good networking event, and it gets quite a bit of coverage on Twitter as well. At least that's been the case during recent years, which is very nice because then people can follow along from anywhere, basically.
Yes, and they web stream it always.
That's true. Yes.
So that's also good. So you can, and I think you can even go back and watch earlier.
Yes.
Earlier versions of the SCEEC universities.
So I'll probably put the link in the show notes. Yeah, because you can go, I think, quite a while back in the archives. So at least 6 or 7 editions of the conference should be online. Not only the recording, including interpretation, so if you want to listen in to how we interpret, you can listen to that, but you can also read the slides and the presentation. So I'll put the link into the show notes afterwards. So that's for pedagogical assistance, and I already said that what the European institutions need in terms of future interpreters is not necessarily the same as what the schools or the universities do, because often there's a bit of a difference between what the private market in those countries needs and what we need. So since you're teaching in Stockholm in Sweden, what's your take on that? Do you mainly train for the institutions, or what does the market look like just in general terms in Sweden or in Scandinavia for that matter? I don't know.
Well, we didn't have an interpreting market before we joined the EU. It was very small, mainly focused on Nordic languages. So the Nordic Council had interpreters. There were no training program in Sweden. And the the big issue for Sweden was community interpreting or interpreting for different migrant communities. So therefore, when we started our first interpreting program at university, or there had been a few before, but not very, not very formalized, so one-off training. So when we started this more formalized, more university-like training, it was really...
Sorry, this was which year when you started?
In 1994, 93. In 1993 okay. was the first course, yeah. So they would graduate just before the Swedish referendum in 1995.
Yeah.
Or sorry, autumn of 94, and we joined in
95. Yeah. Yes.
And when that started, we were completely turned towards the European institutions, mm-hmm. and also there was an extreme lack of Swedish interpreters. So obviously, if you pass the course, it was basically a ticket to
Brussels.
If not,
or Strasbourg for that matter.
If not as a staff interpreter, at least on the freelance list. Yeah. Obviously, there were tests at the institutions as well, but because the lag was huge, there was a very, I wouldn't say easy to get in, but at least you weren't restrained by the fact that we don't have any places or we don't have any more space for you. So this means that our training up until now has been very much driven by the European market and the European institutions. And even in to the extent that when there was a considerable change in the demand for Swedish interpreting due to Swedish government policy, we stopped giving interpreting training for 7 years.
Because the Swedish government did not insist on having interpretation in Brussels?
Because the Swedish government decided that they would be in the forefront of stopping the interpreting in the European Union.
Yes.
And doing that, they would have to be a role model, of course, and therefore they asked for the mere minimum of interpreting. Mm. This was a huge blow to the Swedish interpreting market, needless to say, but also we stopped training interpreters. Despite the fact that it might still be needed on the private market and under different conditions, but conference interpreters were not trained for a seven-year period. And now we have rethought and recast our training a lot, I think, and we're still in the process of doing that because we feel that we need to have a training which is regular because it costs too much to have such a big... intermission or interruption.
Yeah, because you basically start from scratch.
You have to start from scratch, and it's very expensive. But that also means that we need to train more for the Swedish market, and for the Swedish market, interpreting first of all is not very big. But those that are in need absolutely need a retour.
And which is usually English?
Which is English or French and German.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. English is the big language, but French and German also. And you would also have to be trained to work for the community, doing community interpreting. So the conference interpreting program is not going to teach community interpreting, obviously, but we need to start thinking about retour.
Yes.
And we've not done that before. Because that's a must for a Swedish market. And we've not really taught marketing for interpreters because you didn't need to market yourself.
Yeah.
You just had to pass the test at the institutions.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And whereas now the situation is different, the interpreter needs to market him or herself and have a solid retour and so on and so forth. So, but we're still in the process of doing all this, so we're not there yet. But yeah, that's an adaptation to the market, as you mentioned.
Yeah, but what is your impression that the demand in Sweden sort of developed because you were training interpreters, or was that just coincidence? Or
I think the demand in Sweden developed because of the European Union as well, because a lot of meetings held in Sweden were organized or demanded by different European agencies or institutions or even, you know, European Works Council, which is not, of course, the European institutions, but still, related to that, or the trade unions who also meet. And because of that, a lot of demand came up for interpreting. In Sweden, we also have a pretty grim situation with agencies undercutting each other. So it is difficult on the Swedish market. I wouldn't say anything else, but still.
So translation agencies or language services.
Yeah, exactly. Translation and interpreting agencies who are bidding for the best bid, and not only. And maybe I shouldn't blame everything on them either, because there's also the agencies of meeting event organizers who bid for the event and who tend to forget about interpreting. So yes, but therefore the marketing for the individual interpreter becomes more important, of course.
Mm. How are you trying to cover that marketing? Because my impression from traditional interpreter training is that it's a bit of an afterthought. And people only now sort of realize that it has to be done. And sometimes the professional associations would step in or maybe give a talk or a presentation. How do you try to cover that?
Well, not so well yet, I think, too. We have our professional organization, of course, AIK, which is very active in Sweden, luckily. They come in and do presentations. We also have the bigger agencies, the bigger interpreting and translation agencies coming in and do presentations. Mm-hmm. But I think that we should have a unit towards the end of the training solely on how to market yourself and what you need, you know, web presence or how to deal with negotiating a price or or how do you even get in touch with those agencies in the first place, and what to do when an agency show up and you don't know what it is, what that type of agency is, and so on and so forth. Mm. Because we are very interpreting is a sort of apprenticeship training still, right? Because the teachers are active interpreters. And I'm not sure we should get out of it, but we have to realize that that's the way it is. But it means that as trainer, we still have a lot of contact with our students afterwards. And obviously, we encourage them to get in touch when they, if they have iffy proposals. But I think we can get better to make them more independent from the beginning. And that would also sort out a bit of that apprentice, because you don't want to be in a situation where you get a job because your teacher recommends you, right? That's not the right way to go about it either, maybe.
Well, at least if you have to rely on it, that's probably not ideal. But I mean,
no.
In theory, there's probably nothing wrong with that.
No, at least
to get started.
Not from an
ethical point. Yeah. But if that's the only way, if you have to rely on having good relationship with former teachers, it might be difficult too.
So you mentioned in the beginning that there was basically no interpreter training in Sweden. So that leads me to the question, how you became an interpreter. Did you train abroad?
I trained in Belgium. But that was just because I missed the deadline for application for the second interpreting training course in Sweden. Okay. My way into interpreting was a highly random, or I don't know what to say, path. Uh-huh. It was nothing I really planned for. I somebody's always sowing a seed somewhere, right? So
that's a good way of putting it.
Yeah.
No, it's true.
So I trained to become a teacher. Mm-hmm. That was my first academic training, and it took a long time to decide to go into academia again.
Language teaching?
Language teaching, French and English. When I finished high school, I vowed I would never go into a classroom ever again.
I can understand.
And I wanted to work with horses. Mm-hmm. So obviously, 5 years later, when my horse career did not work out as I thought it would, and I had to decide what to do, it wasn't with a happy feeling I went back to academia. Mm-hmm. And I don't think I would have done it hadn't it been for teacher training not being popular then either. So they had this last-minute enrollment. So in July, I enrolled to begin in August.
That was in Brussels or Mons?
No, this was in Sweden.
In Sweden,
In the early 1990s.
Yeah.
And, God, I'm ancient. And
I can cut this out.
No, it's okay. I think I like it to be ancient. But anyhow, so I reluctantly went back to academia and realized I loved it. It was really nice. I loved teacher training. I was totally committed to become a teacher. I got all up and about second language acquisition. So I went to this conference on second language acquisition where I met a lovely lady whose husband was an interpreter at the European Union. And I wouldn't have known hadn't I bought her coffee. Just, you know, you get up from the table and anyone else for coffee? And she was the only one saying yes. So I sat next to her and found out her husband was an interpreter, and she heard that I was Swedish and I had English and French. And she said, oh, but my husband says that there's a huge lack of Swedish interpreters now and you have to check that out. And, you know, that sounded fun, but I was also very determined to become a teacher. So we parted and nothing more.
But that was the seed you were mentioning earlier?
Sorry, that was the seed. Exactly, that was the seed. Because a couple of months later, when I was visiting Brussels for other reasons, I actually called her and said that, well, you know, your husband said that that he'd be happy to show me around and maybe it would be interesting after a while, after all. So he did, and I met him and I was shown around, and I'm very ashamed to say that he put me in a booth and I interpreted into and out of all the possible languages, and I thought it went so well. And I'm very happy nobody recorded me then. And I'm even more ashamed of admitting that I even told him that I'd done that and that it went so well. And he was kind enough not to...
It's just glossing over it.
Exactly. Not taking me out of that impression.
Quite
right there and then, but he took me to the then head of Danish booth, who was also head of the Scandinavian booths because we had just joined. And who also said that, you know, but we're desperately lacking interpreters and you must apply. And I knew then, because this was in June, and I knew that the time for application was in April. So I was like, yeah, nice, but it's not going to happen. And he insisted and he said, but I have this professor. I have a friend in Mons who is an interpreting professor. Could you please contact him and see if he can organize something? So I contacted the professor and they said that if you're willing to come to Mons, we have a Scandinavian department and we'd be happy to teach you.
Do they still have that?
Yes, they still do. I wouldn't recommend anybody with Swedish mother tongue doing that, though, because it's basically based on Danish. And it was really hard to not be taught in your mother tongue. And I relied a lot, again, on the institutions because I could come back to the European Parliament and do all the... They had a stage at the same time for Swedish interpreters, and I could participate as much as possible in that stage parallel to my training. And if they hadn't done that, I wouldn't have passed. No way. But that way I got the exposure to Swedish mother tongue that I needed, and it went well. So.
And that was a 2-year course?
No, that was a one-year. They had, I don't know if they still do that, but they have a 4-year typical BA interpreting training. And then at that time, they also had a 1-year on the master's level, une maîtrise, for conference interpreting. And that was the one I took. And I passed avec distinction, so I was very happy.
And did you then go back to Sweden first, or did you go straight to taking the test and everything?
I also have the bad habit of being married to an army officer, so... So the reason I even got to Mons was that he was, at that time, he was in Bosnia with the UN mission. And I'm not sure I would have left him and gone for a year to Mons if he'd not been in Bosnia. But he was away, and I didn't have anything to do. And my teacher training was about to... I graduated from my teacher training, and, you know, I could just as well do that as anything else.
When I was abroad for my semester abroad from university, I was in Russia, and I had already... I already lived together with my then future wife, and she said, okay, well, I might as well go somewhere else. And then she spent a few months in The Hague.
Yeah.
I can relate to that, yeah.
And if you don't have, I mean, it is also, of course, you have to be determined. Mm. But it is also a sort of sequence of events that if they happen at the same time, then...
Things just fall into place somehow.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so I finished my interpreting training and I got a 2-month stage from the European Parliament to sort of fill in the gaps.
So is that like an in-house training?
Yes, that's an in-house training. Obviously, it was less languages at that time in 96.
It was before the Big Bang enlargement, as they call it.
Yes. So in 96, it was less languages and less booths, which meant that the trainees had much more time to spend in booth and time to be on site. Mm-hmm. And I guess security wasn't as serious either, so we had our own trainee badge.
Yeah. That wouldn't be possible anymore, no. I think.
And we could walk around quite freely. Mm. So what we did was, apart from interpreting as much as we could, of course, but we also walked around to different committee meetings and different working group meetings and just taking notes. And obviously, before your test, that's extremely useful.
Yes, that's true.
So I did that for 2 months after my training course, and then in July, end of July, I did a freelance test and passed. But then due to my husband, or thanks to my husband maybe, I had to go back and live in Stockholm.
Okay.
Because he couldn't, an army officer doesn't move that freely, especially Sweden isn't a member of the NATO, so they don't move that freely around. So I went back to Sweden and worked on a freelance basis. And obviously that gives you a little bit of missions and assignments, but not that much.
Yeah. So you work both in Brussels/Strasbourg and in Sweden?
Yes, and in Sweden. And as much as I could, because I didn't have a retour. So I did a lot of community interpreting, where maybe the retour requirements are less. Less demanding, and also the private market into Swedish.
So what does the private market look like? I'm just trying to imagine, because in Germany you would have companies, small companies, big companies that have meetings with clients, or a conference with people, and they would have interpreters. But you said in the beginning that there wasn't much of a market to begin with. So what kind of jobs would that be?
That would be in Parliament. And government having guests or visitors or lectures. The Nobel Prize Week is, of course, busy, depending on your language combination, of course, but usually there are lectures that need to be interpreted.
And that would be simultaneous, usually, I suppose.
Usually simultaneous, depending on the... Of course, their foreign lectures, they have been translated beforehand, unfortunately. But but they also have a lot of informal lectures where interpreting is sometimes in demand, at least. And then European Works Council, of course, and also different, as I said, missions from the European Union to Sweden.
Yeah.
Investigating or looking or meeting different things. It used to be academic conferences quite a lot as well, but I actually spoke for my students' account. I spoke to the event services at the university, and they said, you know what, they've cut almost all the interpreting now. We used to have a lot of interpreting 10 years ago, and now it's down to using English.
It's all English.
Yeah. So that's sad. So I suggested that maybe my students could come along still, and maybe people would feel that would be an added value. Yeah. So that's what we'll try to arrange next year.
As long as the infrastructure is in place, that should be possible.
Yes.
Yeah, because that was the case at Leipzig University, where I studied, that we would have conferences from time to time or public events where we would just man the booth and have some proper experience. So that was nice. So it's a shame when that goes away.
Yeah,
that's true. So you then went back to Sweden, to Stockholm. And how did you become an interpreter trainer? Was that much later, or did that start more or less straight away?
It started more or less straight away, but that was a longer and more bumpy road.
Because what sometimes happens, at least in German universities, is that once you have your degree, you stay on and you teach the younger students, yes, as it were, that kind of thing.
But as we didn't have any interpreters, we hardly had any interpreting teachers either. And the interpreters who worked as teachers were also worked a lot with interpreting, because as the Sweden were joining, the need was desperate. So obviously, also the need for interpreting teachers was big at that time. But there was also, maybe that's the apprentice side to it, but there was also a certain reluctancy to let new colleagues in to the training, to the training programs. So we would be, not only me, other new colleagues as well, we would be asked to come and teach, but only on a very occasional basis and doing the bare minimum, just to fill in where it was necessary, and obviously no proper interpreting training or something, interpreting teaching training. But it started almost immediately after that. I think my first classes were, I started as a freelance in 96, and I think my first classes were in 99, so very fairly shortly after. And then I struggled along and taught here and taught there and did a little bit of everything, because I thought it was, I mean, I trained to become a teacher and I liked that, so obviously I thought it was fun.
Because I was just thinking about that, there is no course that you can take if you want to become an interpreting teacher. I mean, it's more or less self-taught. I mean, there's some literature, I suppose, that you can read, but
there's a lot of good literature, but I'm also surprised about the Training for Trainers course now that it's so little theory-based. I mean, they are extremely seasoned trainers, and everything that they say can be found in the theory and even researched, but they don't link to it. And that's and at the local universities you wouldn't have any particular interpreter trainers course. We did run one 10 years ago, maybe or more, but it wasn't very successful, because I think then, on the contrary, too much was placed on theory, and the interpreting teachers came there and wanted to get didactic training and methodologies and hands-on pedagogy, not pedagogical thinkers. But got more of pedagogical thinkers, and but we're trying to remedy that as well in Stockholm. We would like to have an interpreting trainers course running regularly, because we realize that both for community and conference interpreting, we cannot just rely only on SCIIC or on AIIC for the training our trainers.
Yeah, because AIIC does Training for Trainers trainings as well, from time to time.
And also very good ones. But, you know, people cannot always travel, and it costs money. And if it's going to be SCIIC, we have to vouch for sending them, and they have to also be chosen by SCIIC, because there are not so many places. So, yeah, so we need to sort that out. So, but I like teaching, and I struggled along.
And how did you then start with the PhD? Was that a necessity to become a proper, air quotes, a proper interpreting teacher?
No. And the PhD actually was a direct consequence of the Swedish government deciding to not hire interpreters anymore, or to try to cut down on interpreting in the European Union. Because I, and not only I, but many of the colleagues in the Swedish booth felt at that time that we need to, you know, I have to look around and look at my resources and see what I can do other than just interpreting. And I didn't start my PhD with the idea of becoming an interpreting teacher. I started it because it would be a good way of spending some time while I realized I wouldn't have much work. And, you know,
Because the PhD continue, takes a lot of time as well.
Exactly, and continue to build on my knowledge and on my CV, and and also preferably earn a little money having a scholarship and so on. So it came out of that, and I was, through my PhD, I was totally convinced that I would not get a position as a as an interpreting teacher when I finished. So that wasn't a drive at all.
Because you were too I don't know, too deep down in theory? Or
No, simply no. Could have been, but no, simply because at that time, that was also during the 7 years recess of interpreting courses. So I was very realistic about it, and I wasn't sure that Sweden would change its opinion, because this was also during I'm losing my dates, but this was the decision was made during the Social Democratic regime, or Social Democratic Parliament regime might be a big word. But the Social Democratic government in Sweden, and at that point in time, I couldn't foresee that there would be a change in government, and all political ideas aside, but we can just confirm that the Social Democrats were less interested in interpreting than the conservative alliance that we had after that. Very interesting. I was holding my breath when we had the change of government again. But so far they have kept the language regime.
We'll keep our fingers crossed.
But it's also very interesting from a political perspective, because the idea of interpreters have always been to that you shouldn't be a language expert, right? You should always be able to express your feelings in whatever language and get help with the language. So to me, that's a very social democratic idea.
It is, that's why I was surprised
but
to hear.
Still, that was not what the social democratic government thought, anyhow.
It was more about saving money. Then.
Yeah, and we worked a lot about selling that idea as well. We worked a lot about on policy, talking to policymakers and so on, but they were not. It was really a deaf ear. They were not listening.
They were
not
interested. Yeah.
So I was that was a pastime. Sounds stupid, but it was a way of pursuing something I liked, because I'd really come to like academia. I'd liked studying. I liked doing research, and I thought that I'll do this for the time being, and then we'll see. And also we didn't have an interpreting training. The Institute for Interpreting and Translation Studies was completely recast at the time. They were threatened to be closed down twice. So no future in this probably.
Pretty gloomy.
And by the time I was nearing the end of my PhD, we had that government change. The demand for interpreting had slowly gone up. I'd gotten more jobs than in many years. So my plan was to just finish the PhD and go back to interpreting.
Just finish.
Just finish.
Yeah, it's just a PhD. And the topic of your PhD is quite interesting, I think, because it also, I think you worked with the institutions as well, or you work with the interpreters who work at the institutions. And maybe tell us about that.
Yeah, this is very delicate. Can I first say that I worked with extremely good interpreters and who are extremely skilled at what they do. And the results that I got, that I know that people talk about from time to time, that about the development of individual interpreters does not mean that the interpreters at the institutions are not good or not experts or not very, very experienced and good at what they do. They are. You wouldn't be at the institutions, you wouldn't be hired, you wouldn't be able to stay if you weren't producing very high quality interpreting. So now that's said.
That was the disclaimer.
That was the disclaimer.
And we do have sort of quality assurance schemes in place.
I always, when I give lectures, I always start with that, because I don't think that people realize how much an interpreter is controlled or evaluated in the daily business. I mean, not only thinking about the fact that you're evaluated towards your customer every day, mm-hmm. but also that working at the institutions, if you're a freelance interpreter once a year, there's a quality evaluation. If you work for both the institutions, there's a there's an assessment for the Parliament and for the Commission. Yes. So there's a lot of assessment for the interpreter, and there's always a line where you cannot be below in order to stay on as a freelance interpreter.
Because there's a more or less direct link between your performance and how many work you get.
Exactly.
Yes.
You're also scored according to that. So if you have a lower score, albeit, you know, allowed to stay, but your score is lower than your colleagues, your colleague will be picked on the quality rating. So,
yeah, so you get less work, that's true.
Yeah, so clearly there is a lot of quality check, and the interpreters working at the institutions are very good. So, but I had, my material was, first I had a cross-sectional material. This means that I was comparing students to novice interpreters, to experts interpreters, and they were different individuals. Mm-hmm. So compared at the same point in time and different individuals.
So that means you recorded?
I recorded them when they did interpreting, and then I transcribed the recordings, and
which is a lot of work.
That's the dull part of it. And I made them into assessment files, both recorded and on transcript, and I had people evaluate them. So they would score them from, they had two scales for scoring, one which was idiomatic Swedish, from not at all to very much so.
And they were, sorry, they were not interpreters, they were pure customers, as we say?
They were
normal
both.
People, or both?
Okay. Yeah, so I had normal, I had pure customers and also interpreting, very experienced interpreters rate them. So two groups rating. And two scales, from idiomatic Swedish, from not at all to very idiomatic, and all the information, is the information left in the interpreting? Do we get the same information from the interpreting that we get from the original? And the same thing there, from not at all to all the information is still there. So, and when I did this cross-sectional assessment, I got the results that from idiomatic Swedish, there was not so much difference between novice interpreters and experienced interpreters, which is probably logical, because once you've done interpreting training and you've worked a couple of years, you're good at doing a good performance.
That's the idea, yeah.
Whereas the students got low scores on everything, or lower scores. But when it comes to information transfer, the very experienced interpreters had a much higher score in information transfer than the novice interpreters, which is also logical.
So it was more complete, basically.
So far everything was fine and well. It was also interesting to, I also had them do retrospection, which is, by the way, a very good exercise with students. When you look at or listen to your own interpreting, or you look at or listen to the original speech, and you go through it methodologically and say, what exactly did I do in this passage to interpret it? Could I do it? Did I leave it out? How did I solve this difficult passage? And then, and through that exercise, I could also see that the very experienced interpreters had much more strategies at hand and could reflect more on what they did. So no surprises at all.
That would be expected.
But then I had this wonderful longitudinal material with interpreters who were recorded at the interpreting program, and then who agreed to be recorded again 15 years later. And interpreters who were, you know, very experienced, seen as good interpreters, had interpreted a lot over the 15 years that had passed, and so on and so forth. And the interesting thing there was that I couldn't find so much difference, neither in performance nor in strategies compared to interpreting, compared to what they did at the interpreting program. And then the first thing you could say is, of course, that they didn't develop.
Yeah, because, I mean, the basic, it sounds obvious, but the basic assumption would be that the more you do it or the longer you do it, the better you get at it.
Yes, exactly.
So the 10,000 hours thing,
Mm. But you could also think about it from two other perspectives, which is what I think is more interesting. First of all, it might say something about the methods we use to compare the experts to the novices when we do that in interpreting research, because we do that a lot. But my research is the only one I know of who have compared the same individuals. So we might know a lot about the difference between individuals, but maybe less about the less about the difference within the one person. Yeah, and obviously, when you pick an expert to be your expert in any research, you wouldn't pick somebody who's just fresh out of interpreting school.
Sure.
You would pick somebody who's seen by the community as an expert. So obviously, here the three that I investigated, they were seen as very good interpreters as well, but maybe they were that at their interpreting program as well. So maybe, you know, it's difficult to say how much would you develop as a person, and how can you measure that? Because maybe there is a way of measuring it, but I just couldn't do it. Maybe my instruments were too blunt.
Yeah, but the thing is, it's already very difficult to evaluate what good interpretation is, because it's highly subjective, and somebody, you know, the one person is more into terminological accuracy or is it idiomatic or not. The other people are just purely interested in accuracy and completeness of information. So I guess that's difficult to.
And there's also this very interesting Spanish research that where they have proven very effectively that you think that you judge some things. For instance, you would say, as a listener, as a pure customer, you would say that I don't care so much about foreign accent, but I care about accuracy. And then exposed to two exact same interpretings where one has a foreign accent and the other doesn't, the interpreting with a foreign accent gets a lower score on accuracy.
Because of the accent?
Probably.
Yeah, we don't know.
I mean, that's the only difference. So, which means that it's very difficult also to tease out what you actually score when you score things. So anyhow, but so they did. So not the difference that I would have expected. And I've really been struggling with this because, you know, I can't say that these people are bad. It would have been so easy if I just picked a few anyhow to say that, okay, but I didn't pick the expert ones.
Yes.
But they're not. They are really good.
Yes.
So it's really hard. And another thing that came across in this research was in the interviews I did with them, because since I couldn't cover a typical long-term research, you would go back to the subject and record the same thing every year or every fifth year or so on. But I had one recording at one point and then 15 years later. So in order to cover the 15 years, I asked them if they would agree on doing in-depth interviews.
Yes.
And they did.
Reflecting
on themselves and their development and so on and so forth. And they did, and they were extremely open. And I was very happy about that because, you know, I'm their colleague too. So it's not so easy to sit down with your colleague and tell you about strengths and weaknesses and
how.
Exactly. But they were very, very open. And one thing that struck me when I read and reread, and I also had other colleagues, research colleagues, reading the transcript, obviously, I'm very, very cautious about their identity. but one thing that was striking was that they talked a lot about techniques to enhance their performance. Learning more about economy, preparing for particularly difficult meeting, learning a new language, working on a specific terminology that was difficult, reading up on current affairs. They even said that, you know, I don't even read a book anymore the same way I used to before I was an interpreter. Because now I read a book, I read for information, I collect information.
It's very much a side effect of being an interpreter.
Exactly. I think we can all relate to that.
Yes.
But none of them said that they practiced anything.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I even asked them, but don't you ever practice? And they said no. Yeah.
Because the things you mentioned are basically about background knowledge, terminology, yeah, and language, exactly, not necessarily about technique.
No.
Mm.
And I was very surprised. And if you compare it to musicians or sports, you know, football players or soccer players or whatever, they are brought up to practice all the time, even after the interpreting training or when they graduate from musical school or whatever.
Yeah, even when they're world famous.
When they're world famous, exactly. And they work with coaches and they have set hours of practice every day and they have very, you know, very goal-focused things that they need to work on. And not just learning a new song, but actually working on the different techniques in their instrument or in their... And this is something that if you don't teach somebody that, then that person cannot be expected to learn it either.
Yeah.
You can do it intuitively, which is very much that I felt that these interpreters did. They had a lot of intuitive things that they related to. For instance, that, you know, I always listen to my colleagues because something, obviously to help them if they are in trouble, but also I hear good things they say, I can note them down, I learn that, and so on. Mm-hmm. But everything, all that was intuitive. So it wasn't, I would have expected maybe what we see more now with younger interpreters,
mm-hmm,
because the competition is ferocious, so you have to do that. But also because maybe we have started to teach it as interpreting trainers.
Uh-huh.
But you would see with younger interpreters that they get together in groups and they do a lot of practice and they have goals.
Yeah.
And I'm curious to know whether, obviously you do that when you get out of interpreting training and you want to pass, for instance, the accreditation test for the institutions, then you would do that a lot.
Yes.
But what happens afterwards?
Mm-hmm.
And
you don't necessarily have an incentive to.
Exactly, because there's no... I mean, I talked about that lower line. You cannot be worse than a certain level.
Hopefully not, yes.
No, hopefully not. But there are no incentives to be better.
Yeah.
And if you're a translator, you can win prizes for good translations,
mm-hmm,
or you can get a scholarship,
mm-hmm,
from your government because only, to subside as a translator.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing like that for interpreters. So why should you be better than the lower level? And then it's only because you want to be, you know, the best possible interpreter,
yes,
that you can be. But there's also life, and you sit in the booth. If you're a staff interpreter, you spend hours and hours in the booth anyway. Would you go home and do exercises after that? Probably not.
Mm.
Which is completely understandable, but still, compared to other virtuosos, whatever field they're in,
mm-hmm,
we don't have that notion of practice.
Yeah.
And I wonder what that does to us as performers.
But I would agree to a large extent that it depends on what your interpreter training was like. For example, when you interpret at university and you get feedback from the trainer or maybe from other students, and I think it really depends on what they do. Do they just focus, okay, you left that out, you said "ah" too many times, that kind of thing. And if you only know that, so it's quite superficial, I think. And if you don't know any better, then probably it's difficult to get there. But I don't know if you've covered that in your PhD, but are there any strategies or recommendations, so things that people who have that inner incentive to be your best interpreter, what they can do? Because I think that the term is deliberate practice.
Yes.
That's more or less what it...
Yes, what I'm after, the thing I've been describing now for the past couple of minutes is deliberate practice, you know, to work very actively with certain exercises to improve your skill, not to add a language or to be better at economical terminology.
Exactly.
But really, if we talk about interpreting, it would be the presentation skill or the transfer skill or really the skills focused only at interpreting.
Mm-hmm.
And what I think would be very useful for that deliberate practice, and I've not heard so many people do it, but maybe more than I think do it, would be would be to sit down with colleagues, right? Mm. To have a group of colleagues where you could actually sit down on, it doesn't have to be after work at 7 o'clock in the evening, but I mean, we don't work every day.
No.
So obviously we could probably find time to do that and have that that peer, you know, to be coached by somebody who are interested in what you do and that you should actually perform better. And because of so much of our assessment is on what we do wrong or that we're not good enough, so we can't stay in the, in the institutions or something like that, or we get a lower score, it would be really great to create an environment where this coaches of yours, because I mean you could be peer coaches, it doesn't have to be somebody particularly trained for that, but a coach that would want you to improve, to become better, and who could, and you could devise different exercises to do in order to improve your interpreting. And I'm sure that even for a very good interpreter, that would improve your interpreting.
Oh, certainly, yeah, I'm quite sure.
But unfortunately, I think it's very difficult to create that type of climate. One of the best, one of the best coaches I've had was when I was once assessed for the European Parliament, and he was so good. He sat down and we went through everything. He's also a trained teacher, so that might be it.
Yeah.
And we really went through everything he'd listened to, and we discussed it and what was lacking and how could I improve that. And so it was really a very beneficial moment. But unfortunately, I didn't get that good a score I'd hoped for, so I was disappointed afterwards anyway. But that kind of environment, without having to be scored or assessed afterwards, just, you know, purely working on improving the skill.
And I heard a very nice presentation from another staff interpreter last week or so, who said that when he's in a meeting that's not particularly difficult, he would think and work on his technique. So he would have more or less décalage, or try a bit more idioms or fewer idioms, that kind of thing. Does that still count as deliberate practice? Because he's working. I mean, it's not really practice, but there are ways to sort of build it into the daily work.
Yes, of course there are. And I also, I would think that, because I would think that if you are in a meeting, you can beforehand decide that, I mean, you would know if it wasn't very particularly technical or difficult, or and you could decide beforehand that today I'm going to do this in this meeting with the sole purpose of trying to improve myself and my technique.
Yeah.
And if you record yourself on top of that, you would have a very, very clear receipt of whether you did that
it's
or not.
It's brutal, yes. Right? It can be quite sobering.
But I also think that, because recordings, I don't know about the German booth, but I know that in the Swedish booth, students even tend to hide that they're recording themselves. After, I mean, in the beginning, everything is okay. But after a couple of years, you're supposed to be good enough. And then if you record yourself, you're first of all, people are worried that you're recording somebody else than yourself. And secondly, it sort of puts you in a, look at me, I'm recording myself, I'm better than you because you're not. I don't mean that I want to send that signal, but I mean that others may...
That probably happens,
or
can
happen. May take in that signal, you know, not deliberately, and be, you know, a bit looking down over their nose and say, oh, so you're recording yourself again.
want to get better.
And then obviously the result would be that you won't record yourself with that colleague again. So So it is a delicate situation.
But that's, maybe to finish things off, that's the idea behind deliberate practice, that let's say, okay, you have an easier meeting today in the morning and you say to yourself, okay, today I'm going to work on décalage or whatever. And then you really focus on that, maybe write it down, record yourself, and then at the end of the day, I mean, you probably don't have to listen to the whole day, but just...
No, but you would evaluate yourself to the goal you'd set and see whether that had improved or not. Yes, that's the idea.
And I think you could do that in a peer coaching context as well, that you say, okay, I have two or three colleagues who do the same on the same day, and then we can sort of talk about it afterwards and compare results, maybe.
Yes.
That sounds great.
Yes. And another thing I want to say, which is very important to me, when we talk about peer evaluation and so on, is that I think that when you are when you are evaluated for your assessment for the institutions, mm-hmm. I think that it's very important that the assessment is done by a core of assessors and only those people, mm-hmm. and that they are trained regularly,
yeah.
a lot more than they are. I know that there are a certain amount of training going on,
mm-hmm.
But I really think that that should be something, you know, they should be the... what do you say? They should be the super assessors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
and being trained for doing only that and have a few people doing it, because, again, it would avoid that you are reluctant because it's, you know, it's so many different people.
Mm-hmm.
So you're reluctant that you would get the same assessment.
Yes.
And also that you would have people assess based on, you know, their own opinion. And obviously, every assessment is on your own opinion.
Yeah.
But the more you talk about it and discuss it and learn about it, the less subjective it becomes. The more you can objectify, if you mm-hmm. like, the task. So so if that could be, you know, strengthened,
yeah, I think that's the key, to have the people who have the experience and a certain degree of training in how to assess. Interpreting, and then also getting the form right, because there's usually a standard form that you have to fill in when you assess someone. And I think there's a whole science unto designing the questions or the cases, the boxes to tick,
yeah.
in a good way, so that exactly you don't have too much subjectivity, but sort of objective criteria as far as possible.
Mm. And obviously that's easier in a bigger booth than in a smaller booth, but mm. I think that the strive should be that, that the whole exercise is as how shall we say, research-based as possible.
Which I think then is a nice end for this session, because that's exactly what we talked about in the beginning, that the ideal should be that SCIC, when we do pedagogical assistance, not only send out the message and say what we want, but that we also to a certain degree get the feedback from research and from science and then try to improve our way of working. I think if we can achieve that,
mm-hmm.
that will be a good result.
Yes, I think so too. And I also think that, you know, there's so much cooperation where we depend on each other.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm talking about training institution versus the user or the customer institution.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore we also, and I know that SCIC do that a lot. And this is not to say that they don't, but therefore... since we rely so much on each other, we must rely on each other for training as well and for doing research and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, look at the institutions, they are a wonderful research base. If I know that I know that from time to time it's more allowed or less allowed,
mm-hmm.
because of how much time that goes into feeding different researchers different things.
Yeah.
And there's also you know, you only have so much resources, but the possibilities of learning more about the interpreting profession and the interpreting as a cognitive process or as a mental process or as a social process is endless.
Yeah.
It's a fantastic resource.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Oh, can I recommend something?
You can, absolutely.
I would recommend every working interpreter to read the, which I so soon hope will be published,
okay.
PhD of a colleague called Fele Duflo in the Dutch booth. She has written a wonderful qualitative PhD on the life as a conference interpreter.
Okay.
And I would really recommend that to colleagues.
Excellent. Thank you.
Thank you.